Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is trade protectionism. With me to discuss calls for the United States to create a trade policy for the middle class is Adam Posen. Adam is president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He has had a distinguished career as an economist. If I listed all of his awards and accomplishments, we would use up all the time allotted for our discussion. So I'll just throw out one example. Adam was made honorary commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II in 2014 for his services to British economic policy as an external voting member of the Bank of England's Rate-Setting Monetary Policy Committee. Now, Adam gained a lot of attention in policymaking circles earlier this summer with his article, The Price of Nostalgia, America's Self-Defeating Economic Retreat, which was published in the May-June issue of Foreign Affairs. Welcome to the President's Inbox, Adam.
Thanks so much, Jim. I'm not just a guest, I'm a listener to the President's Inbox, so thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being a listener. I'm even more delighted to have you as a guest. And I think where I'd like to begin, Adam, is with what seems to be the political conventional wisdom in Washington these days. And that is when you look at both Democrats and Republicans, no one seems eager to pursue new trade agreements. And that reluctance reflects a political consensus, a bipartisan consensus, that America's economic openness over the past two or three decades was tragically misguided. And the story goes something like this. We signed a range of trade agreements that gave foreign competitors access to American markets. Those competitors didn't return the favor. The result has been unfair foreign competition that stole American jobs and helped destroy the American middle class. Is that a fair description of what actually happened over the past quarter century or so?
It's a very accurate description, Jim, of the shared views by large numbers of both Democrats and Republicans in Washington, but it is a completely inaccurate description of what actually happened. And some relatively straightforward, honest data work that my colleagues at the Peterson Institute and I have done that gets covered in my foreign affairs piece sort of documents this. In reality, since roughly 2000, around the time that everyone agrees China became a major factor in global trade, the U.S. started withdrawing across both Democratic and Republican administrations. Our share of trade in the economy has barely moved over the last 20 years. It's not gone up very much. In fact, it's mostly stayed down. While the share of trade of most other, in fact, all other rich economies, including ones thought to be aggressive trade people like Germany, France, and Japan, have gone up a lot. And it's not just trade. Our willingness to take in immigrants went down significantly over this period. It's been on a steady downward trend since the early 90s, whereas again, even countries thought of as pretty close like Japan or Australia have started taking in more immigrants. Foreign direct investment has been moving sideways in a world where most other economies are seeing huge increases, even in China. Just every substantive thing you look at, and then you mentioned rightly, interest in trade deals, in expanding new markets, and the U.S. has done very little of that. We did a Korea-U.S. deal 15, 20 years ago that was really about protecting U.S. auto industry. And the USMCA renegotiation of NAFTA is essentially the same thing. It's about protecting the auto industry. We can debate whether or not that's going to pay off at all, but it sure isn't anything like the EU and Japan concluding a trade deal or a dozen countries joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
So how would you explain, Adam, the fact that so many people see the story so differently? Again, the story is we signed all these trade deals. They were rotten trade deals. Donald Trump said even stronger things about it. My sense is that Democrats, while they may use kinder words to describe trade deals, also heavily critical about them. So what accounts for this disjuncture between what we think happened and what has actually happened?
You're absolutely right that it's a very tightly believed view of the world that the U.S. has sold out to China, has sold out to trade in general, and I cannot fully explain it. All I can say is that as we're seeing with things in financial markets, as we're seeing with vaccinations, sadly, people can believe very strongly things that are simply not true, and it's just not true that the U.S. sold out that way. There were certainly mistakes made, or not even mistakes, there were certainly people who were overly optimistic about what would happen with China if they were admitted to the WTO, if we traded with them a lot, in terms of them becoming more open or more democratic. That's a fine thing to point out. But on the economic facts, it's not there. There's been a lot of attention paid to what's called the China shock. In the same issue of Foreign Affairs, one of the authors of that study had an article about assisting people displaced by trade. But the fact is that the share of total employment in the U.S. displaced by the China shock, even on the high estimates, is roughly under 1% of the total workforce. In fact, it's in the tenths of a percent of the workforce. When you compare it to how many people just normally lose their jobs or get fired or move around in the U.S. economy. So it is very deeply believed. It is also false. I cannot patronizingly explain or deeply insight why, but it is false.
Well, when we talk about the China shock, again, that refers to the decision to sign up to China's entry into the World Trade Organization, which gave it better access to the U.S. market. You've just sort of gone through why you think the China shock wasn't or didn't have the impact often attributed to it. What about NAFTA? I've had the pleasure of both living in the American Middle West, Michigan in particular. I've also had the chance to live in the American South and Texas specifically. There are very different views of the benefits of NAFTA, depending on whether you are north of the Mason-Dixon line or south of the Mason-Dixon line. But again, obviously, a lot of talk about how NAFTA had led to this big sucking sound as jobs went down to Mexico.
Yeah. And again, it's something that has a little more justification than the China shock, but very little. If we go back, and you and I are old enough to remember, back in the mid-90s when the NAFTA agreement was coming up for approval in the U.S. Congress, Ross Perot was talking about the giant sucking sound you meant, and then Vice President Al Gore debated him and frankly walked up the floor with him, not just in my opinion, but in the opinion of all the polls taken after that event. And things did not work out as the critics of NAFTA claimed. What we did see was a very strong decline in the number of desperate people coming across the border because there were more good jobs created in the Maquiladora, in the north region of Mexico, integrated with the U.S. auto industry. There were more exports created by NAFTA, both in the sense that there was a bigger market in Mexico and Canada, but also in the sense that it made the North American production more competitive on the world market. And so we took back some market share versus the rest of the world. Again, it didn't work out the way the most optimistic people thought. It did not lead to a huge transformation and reform of the Mexican economy. It did not lead to, you know, an enormous jump in the number of manufacturing jobs. What did happen that was real and arguably was negative was some people in highly paid union jobs in northern states in auto and auto parts lost jobs to people in non-unionized jobs in the southern U.S. and in Mexico. Again, the numbers of this are vastly exaggerated. And more importantly, a lot of those jobs would have gone away without NAFTA because simply we wouldn't have had the export markets and people would have bought cheaper cars from abroad. And B, because the amount of job loss was not that big compared to what normal people in service industries, in medical industries, and in other industries in this country suffered anyway, in the sense that just as part of a capitalist economy, people lose their jobs and move to new jobs. So I don't want to say there was no pain due to NAFTA, but just as with the China shock, it's vastly exaggerated and it's just not there in the data.
Okay, I want to talk a bit about non-manufacturing jobs. Before they do that, I want to sort of button up this conversation we're having here about the impact of the China shock or of NAFTA. I mean, my takeaway is really twofold. One is that any trade deal is going to create winners and losers. That's the nature of how it happens. And of course, people who lose from a deal are likely much more politically active and vocal than those who had benefited from the deal, because those who benefit from the deal don't say, hey, the reason I'm doing so well is because of the deal, but because of my own hard work, my ingenuity, my being innovative and the rest, which is why, you know, if you go to Michigan or Ohio, NAFTA is a four-letter word, and it's viewed more positively in the South or in Texas, which benefited in many ways from the trade flows generated by NAFTA. But my second takeaway in this discussion, Adam, is that you can have localized effects. And I'd like to sort of get your response to this, because what I've heard from a number of people is, yes, maybe the number of overall manufacturing jobs lost wasn't that great, but they were concentrated. And so when General Motors, let's say, shuts down a plant in Ohio, it's not just the workers at the GM plant who are all of a sudden out of luck. It is the stores, the restaurants, support services in those communities. Now, all of a sudden, they're going to be out of work because of ripple effects and multiplier effects. And the real issue here is sort of the regional impact. How do you respond to arguments like that.
Yeah, this is undeniable. This being what you're saying, Jim, about when you lose a major employer in a region, especially a non-urban place where the major employer could be a dominant employer with few alternatives. The impact is large and persistent. And there is no question that it gets reinforced because it usually affects tax revenues and real estate values, and so does have ongoing effects on those communities. So that's absolutely true. But I want you to think about what I just said and you just said. It's whenever a major employer leaves. It's not just trade. It's if Kodak goes out of business, not because of trade, but because we now have digital cameras. It's everybody always talks about Blockbuster. That's just an individual store. But, you know, the whole electronics industry has a different set of players now than it did 20 years ago. Technology, tastes, politics, demographics, these all affect demand for companies and demand for their products. And so you can have this kind of localized effect, nothing to do with trade. And in fact, in the data, there are 20 to 50, depending on which estimate you look at, but 20 to 50 fold as many of those kinds of jobs being lost with local displacement for every one manufacturing job that got lost.
So technology is a big player in this. I often hear statistics being bandied about, like in 1960, it took 10 steel workers to make a certain amount of steel. And in 2020, it only takes one steel worker to produce the same amount.
Yeah. So, I mean, the simplest way to see this is if you, again, continue to focus on manufacturing, which I want to get back to because I don't think that's fair to most American workers. But if we continue to focus on manufacturing, you know, we're producing the same share roughly of GDP and higher value added than we used to in 1960 in manufacturing with a fraction of the workforce. And that's a way of telling you that productivity has gone up, technology has gone up. Now, again,
and that's a good thing, right? I mean, you become more productive because you want
and the economy as a whole. But it is something that displacement happens. But what I want to keep coming back to, and my colleague Robert Lawrence, by the way, at the Peterson Institute, has written a lot about this and shown how the same trend has basically happened in Germany and Japan. They started at higher levels of manufacturing employment, but they've declined at roughly the same rate, irrespective of their trade surpluses and their protections and all that. It's very clearly technology is the big player.
And that's why if you look at China, my sense is that manufacturing in China has been on a downward spiral. It's actually a big challenge for the Chinese government because they got to find jobs for the people who are being displaced by more efficient firms.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I have this on the website. The Chinese employment in manufacturing hit peak roughly, I think, 2012, and it's been declining slowly then, both in absolute terms and as a share of the workforce. And in China, they've done more to keep alive their old dead industries. And there are issues that because they throw so much money into their steel industry, for example, that it's unfair. But again, what you're saying is correct, Jim, that China still has displacement problem, cannot make these places where the steel was overnight suddenly have alternative jobs, cannot make those steel firms competitive in any sense just by throwing money at them. But I want to get back to this broader point, which is, remember, 70 to 80% of the U.S. economy is service employment.
Okay, so let's talk about that, Adam, because I'm curious. Whenever I listen to a discussion of trade policy, it gravitates toward manufacturing jobs. It's always framed in terms of manufacturing jobs. But as you point out, manufacturing jobs are a small slice of the overall employment picture. So why are we talking about manufacturing when so many people hold non-manufacturing jobs?
Well, this goes to why my piece was in Foreign Affairs was titled The Price of Nostalgia. Similar to things in foreign policy and domestic politics, in cultural politics, there's a great deal of nostalgia for this idealized America of the mid-century, of the stable family in the small town, which is always white and which is always male in terms of domination. And I'm sorry to put it that bluntly, but, you know, with good and bad motivations, and we saw under Trump very bad motivations for this, there's just an obsession that a white, not overly educated person who's male gets more noise and more attention when they leave a job and when they are forced to adjust. And we know that African Americans in large numbers moved north at one point to take and west to take industrial jobs. And then at another point, among them moved back south, or their children moved back south to Atlanta, to the Carolinas to take jobs. We know that women, particularly single women in the workforce, were forced to adjust when word processing replaced secretarial jobs, when all kinds of computer work replaced all the various various office worker jobs. And there was never this hue and cry that these people were getting somehow unfairly treated. And yet whenever, I shouldn't exaggerate this, but often when a white male, particularly a less educated white male who does macho things with heavy stuff, loses their job, and particularly because it's somehow noble that it's in rural or ex-urban Ohio or West Virginia, not in New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, that this is somehow more worthy of attention. Now, part of this is pure political cynicism, that people make the assessment that in Wisconsin or West Virginia or Pennsylvania, those angry white males are the swing vote and you have to pander to them. But part of this just is, I think, part of the same kind of cultural reckoning we need to make with sexism and racism in this country applies to the obsession with manufacturing. And one of the things I point out, again, it's just very simple data, is manufacturing hasn't been fair in terms of representation for non-white people, for females. So we have this image of Rosie the Riveter. We have this image of African Americans very happily getting out of certain jobs in the South to take manufacturing jobs. And those people do exist. But manufacturing remains overwhelmingly male. And manufacturing employment of people without college degrees, with high school or less, is disproportionately white. If you look at the share of Blacks or self-identifying Hispanics in the population who have less than a college education, they're quite, you know, you get up to numbers 20-30%. And yet they're only around 10-15% of the manufacturing workforce. So again, I'm not saying there's some great conspiracy here to keep down African Americans or women or Hispanics, but I am saying that this nostalgia that we've seen be toxic in other fields of public life in the U.S., I think is a large part of the reason people obsess with manufacturing in the U.S.
So, Adam, we have a manufacturing workforce that literally does not look like America. It is disproportionately white, disproportionately male. And I'm struck by something, though, and that is a great deal of criticism about U.S. trade policy comes from people who describe themselves as progressives. And they argue that trade policy has been rigged against the little person, taken jobs away from people, undermined the American middle class. Yet these are also people who put a spotlight on the issue you just did, which is the extent to which many populations have been marginalized and discriminated against. So what is it from your vantage point that progressives are missing as they talk on the one hand about trying to lift up women, minorities, and the rest in their hostility to trade policy?
It's a really good question. And I think part of what they're missing is just the hangover that because the unions, for all their good and bad and limitations in the U.S., have ended up focusing so much on trade as the scapegoat, because that was something partly they believed in, partly that was something they could effectively block and say to their members, we are blocking NAFTA, or we are correcting NAFTA, or we are not letting trade go.
We're delivering for you.
We're delivering for you because we can't deliver on the things that we really should be delivering on and which we were, like fairer taxes, like better rights for organizing and so on. I think that's part of it. But I think a bigger part of it is just that there is a focus on people, not so much as individuals, but as groups, right? So if you're more intellectually minded, you have these concepts of the working class and the, you know, to sound Marxian, the proletariat, which people don't say anymore, but that lingers. Or you have identity politics of groups. And once you do that, then you start focusing on the rise and fall of locations, right? And our congressional system, our electoral map reinforces that for obvious reasons. But in the end, speaking not just as an economist, but someone who I try to think of myself as progressive, frankly, I care a lot more about individuals than I do about places or their identity. And so what you need to be progressive and still allow change in the economy is a much more individually targeted, portable welfare state than we currently have. And we've seen successes in places like Denmark, like Germany, but elsewhere, where the emphasis is not so much on resurrecting places or keeping jobs in a place, but making people more mobile, very aggressively matching them with jobs. The UK has just not shown that they ended up with much lower unemployment than they expected to as a result of the coronavirus, in part because they put a lot of money into these so-called active labor market policies, which are these, you know, essentially do-gooder attempts to really help individuals get jobs and help them move to jobs or commute to jobs. It's just a lot of issues politically about emphasizing individuals rather than locations or communities.
Adam, I want to pursue your views on possible policy solutions. But before we get any deeper into that, I'd like to ask the flip side of the question, which is, and if I can borrow your phrase, about the policy of nostalgia. What are the costs of sort of sticking with this policy of nostalgia?
I think there's some very severe costs. I mean, the first thing I'll just say is there are obviously economic costs. I mean, direct inefficiency costs of everybody has to pay more for stuff. We have smaller markets to go into because all our steel using industries, all our chips using industries end up being uncompetitive. There's less growth. But that's the boring stuff that basically a lot of progressives, as well as people on the right, say, well, that's not important. That's just economists focusing on nickels and dimes, and that's not important. So I agree, there are things more important than that. But let's just remind everybody, there is a direct economic cost to doing this.
Tariffs cost jobs.
Yeah, full stop. You get less immigration, you get less employment, you get less opportunities, done. But anyway, you can say it's worth it to sacrifice something economic for this progressive goal or this national goal. But that's where I think it really fails. When we look across societies over time, a closed society generally has less innovation, entrenches the advantages of the incumbents, whoever are the white males of that given society, tends to feed rather than buy off, frankly, right-wing, near-fascist nationalist policy. It tends to entrench the privilege of corporations who are deemed national champions, and they get soft economically, but they get abusive politically. A young colleague of mine, Anna Stansbury, has documented how where you have a dominant local employer, minimum wages, even if they're legal, don't really get paid. The burden's on workers to prove that their regulations or social safety is being violated. I mean, this is all very much part of when you're not open to competition, to new ideas, when people don't have encouragement or choice to move or change, that other people take advantage of it. And so this move of the U.S. for the last 20 plus years to be ever more closed while scapegoating at the world is, I think, a major contributing factor to things that some people in the Biden administration care deeply about changing, like the concentration of corporate power, the ability of employers to exploit workers, the treatment of migrants, the ability of small businesses and innovations to come up. And then, of course, it gets into all the foreign policy issues that I know you and others are very much concerned about, that if American isolationism on the foreign policy front is reinforced by economic isolationism or economic withdrawal, as I put it, that has other costs, as costs to human safety and human rights. But I just want to emphasize that this isn't a neutral choice. This isn't about, oh, if we keep out trade, we're looking after our people or it's for the middle class. If we keep out trade and get caught up in this nostalgia, we are locking in who are the middle class and who can get into the middle class to a large degree. And we are setting ourselves just as other countries. We used to lecture people in Latin America or South Asia. If you have a closed economy, you create corruption, you create incentives for bad production, you create incentives to stop innovating or disincentives to innovate, really. And we're already seeing that in the U.S. There are a lot of good scholars and policymakers who've talked about these things, and I think people underestimate how much our closed-mindedness and closedness has contributed to these bad outcomes for the U.S.
So, Adam, where do we go from here? I mean, we can talk all we want about counterfactuals if we had pursued this policy 50 years ago or not entered into that trade deal 25 years ago. We can have those arguments, but they're, you know, by definition, both unanswerable and irrelevant. What do you do about a state or region that's already been heavily hit? I just recently drove from southeastern Michigan back to Washington, D.C., through a good portion of Ohio and Pennsylvania, and you see a number of factories that are closed and shuttered. I mean, drive by the Lordstown GM plant in northeastern Ohio, big plant, no activity. What do we do about that? Do we focus on trying to regenerate those communities?
I think we focus on trying to help the individuals in those communities. I mean, that's my fundamental guiding star here.
So people, not places.
People, not places is a nice way to put it. What does that mean? It means much more emphasis on portable benefits for people. That it's not about, oh, you've lost your job through trade, we're going to retrain you in that job or try to protect that job. It's about you have health insurance that you can take with you, at least at some minimum level. You have social care and availability of daycare and childcare and food for children so that you don't feel, oh, I can't leave the town of my birth because my sister's there and I don't have a safety net if I have to move. We do things that we know work in other countries that spend anywhere from 2 to 10 times as much as we do on these so-called active labor market policies, which is an umbrella of policies to really help people match with jobs. We do things that are about investing in transportation infrastructure, which the Biden administration wants to do, and many people bipartisan in Congress want to do, but with an eye to making it possible for people to get to and from where the jobs are at a reasonable rate, both rate and time and rate of expense. And to pick up two issues where I think the libertarian right and the mainstream left in the U.S. have got agreement that I think are really right to be agreed, is some deregulation of zoning laws to make it easier. So in the urban places like San Francisco or New York, where there's the most job growth and the most activity, people who don't have huge salaries can afford to live there. And some deregulation of these crazy non-compete agreements and state-level accreditations of various jobs.
This is like if you do a nail salon in Ohio, right, you got to take a new test if you want to do it in New Mexico.
Exactly. And if you're just a poor working person who's doing a nail salon, not because it's your deep passion in life to do nails, but because that seems like a good opportunity with low capital and I can do this, having a cost to retrain and reaccredit yourself as a nail salon owner or a nail salon technician in a different state is meaningful. It's a deterrent.
But it applies also to things like barbers and lawyers and doctors and real estate agents.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things aren't necessarily to help the consumer, but to insulate an industry.
Yeah. So friends of mine at places like the Cato Institute and American Enterprise Institute on the one hand, and people like my colleague Jason Furman when he was CEA chair under Obama, they agree these are things we should get rid of. So again, the people not places you mentioned, it just more broadly, things that make it so people can be more mobile. Just another one of these basic economic facts. It used to be one of the assumed attributes of the U.S. was people would move around for opportunity. We mentioned the huge movements that African Americans have made. You think of the movements that for many people their immigrant grandparents made or that Hispanics in the previous generation made. Our mobility levels now are lower than most mobility levels in Western Europe.
I think most people would find that surprising because the vision of America is a place where people pick up stakes and they go somewhere else in order to make a name for themselves. It's our self-image.
That's our self-image, but it's just not true and it hasn't been true for several years. And similarly, labor force participation. I mean, we have this image that was very real when it started in the 70s and 80s of Europe having these sclerotic, as the term was, labor markets. You know, people could never be fired. People could never be hired. People didn't move. That's no longer true. Female labor force participation is higher, not just in France and Italy, but in Japan than in the U.S. You know, and this is the result of policy changes. So there are things we can do to make it better for people. And getting past this nostalgic view and this false view of trade is, I think, a necessary step to doing the things that really matter for the middle class and matter for the working people.
Well, one thing I should note on this score is that a number of things that need to be done, certainly in terms of removing or liberalizing licensing requirements or things that aren't done at the federal level, they have to be done at the state level. They fall into the domain of the states going forward. And I'm not sure how popular such ideas are in many state capitals, given the fact that groups organize to protect their interests. I mean, I think the point you've made about manufacturing applies writ large. When people have things, they try to mobilize politically to protect them. I mean, one of the reasons why you keep zoning laws is because if you get rid of them, yes, more development can come. But if you don't want that development because it's destroying the aesthetic of where you live or it's going to drive out your home price, drive it down, then you're going to be against that. That's the nature of politics.
Absolutely. And it is the nature of politics. But I just, again, I want to encourage through our conversation, people in the U.S. to just do a thought experiment. For years, we would go to places, whether it was democracies like Germany or Italy, or autocracies like China or places in Latin America, and we would say, you know, reform is good for you. I realize it's tough. If you open yourself up to the world and you see other examples and you're forced to compete, your economy will become not just more efficient, but fairer. And we used to, we meaning not me personally, but U.S. leadership, U.S. opinion leaders used to go do that to places. And frankly, that's how Japan got rich. That's how Korea got rich. That's how Western Europe got rich. And it's time for the U.S., instead of constantly saying we're a leader or we're going to take everything back, to say, hey, maybe we should do some reform. Maybe we should recognize that we're falling short on so many things compared to other rich democracies. Maybe we can learn something from others.
So the teacher should learn something from what he's been teaching or she's been teaching.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't take away the political issues you rightly raised, Jim, but it's just there are other democracies that have gotten past that. to say, okay, we got to make things fairer. We got to make things more competitive in a good sense so the incumbents don't keep everybody out. And so if other countries can do it, the U.S. can.
I want to ask you one last question, Adam, and that has to do with the bills that are now currently being debated on Capitol Hill. One is a big infrastructure bill. It's called the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill. We'll see if that bipartisanship holds up. There's also this reconciliation bill, which may be $3.5 trillion, maybe a lot less than $3.5 trillion. Do you see things in those bills that begin to address the concerns you have here, or that may move us in a direction where we are worrying about protecting people rather than jobs?
I see some, yes. And there are some things in those bills, the two major infrastructure packages variously defined that you mentioned, that are very positive about enabling people to get opportunities and feel more protected. You know, there's a lot of Sturm und Drang of fire about the idea of, is something non-physical infrastructure or not? I think anything that's a lasting investment that improves the well-being of the economy is worth pursuing, especially when interest rates are so low. So some of the things that are mentioned, the transportation, but in particular in the so-called reconciliation bill, things which make it easier and safer for parents to not have to choose between staying at home with their kids versus going to work. Things that make it easier and safer for young mothers or single women to move and not feel they're going to be left alone and taken advantage of. And these include some of the child care payments we're talking about. These include investments in child care. Also, accreditation. You and I went back and forth a minute ago about this. You know, the investments in making community college much more affordable for a lot of people. And that is a huge benefit to the U.S. and to our labor supply and to people's ability to get new jobs. And, you know, there are a lot of things that aren't being done, but there are some real components in these bills that I think will make a material difference to people. And again, it's not just idle theory. We've seen in Japan them transform the number of women in the workforce over the span of a few years as a result of this kind of investment. We've seen in the UK, despite a lot of other problems going on there, them having a much more efficient labor market response than we did to the crisis because they invested more in active labor market policies. I mean, this is tangible. This is real.
So at the end of the day, you want a stronger, more robust social safety net, if I can use that framing, which leads me to ask a question. I know I said I only ask you one more question, but I'm going to break my own rule here, Adam, and address the charge made by many critics of these bills. America can't afford these investments.
Yeah, I think that's a mistake. I think it was much easier to make the case that America couldn't afford the enormous amount of excess handouts to everybody under $75,000 a year in the package in January than these investments. Interest rates on long government bonds are incredibly low. The likely tax revenues and growth increases we get out of these investments is quite high. And even as proposed before the pushback from some more conservative members of Congress, the pay-fors are, I think, maybe not exactly enough, but are much better than they were in, say, the January package, and spread over multiple years make a lot of sense. So I disagree with the idea that the U.S. can't afford this. I mean, ultimately, I've said this on many other occasions in more economic speak environments, but essentially, just like we have to move from places to people in terms of thinking about who we're serving, in our fiscal discussion, we have to move from talking about deficits and debt to talking about investments and interest rates. We have to be talking about actual debates over which programs are going to pay off and which are not. And that's much more important than some arbitrary number about the deficit or the debt at any given time, as recent events have proven.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Adam Posen, President of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I highly recommend that you read his article in the May-June issue of Foreign Affairs entitled The Price of Nostalgia, America's Self-Defeating Economic Retreat. Adam, I could go on asking you questions. I have to bring it to an end. Let me just say thank you for an enjoyable and illuminating conversation.
Thank you so much, Jim. I'm really proud to be on the President's Inbox and to be publishing in Foreign Affairs. I appreciate it.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Caldas with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.